Renaissance Recall with Jim Miller is part of Grey Towers Productions.
Ha! Jamboree! Ha! Jamboree! Ha! You ring-tail sailors coming up behind! Ha! Jamboree! Ha! Jamboree! Jenny, keep your tailpiece warm! Now, me lads, be of good cheer!
Welcome to Renaissance Recall! My name is Jim Miller. We interview the people who play in Yesterday. And I've got two people to interview today. We were going to have Bobby, but we're going to have him next week. And we've got Cornelia Rutherford. And we've got...
Corey Denby.
I didn't hear the last name.
Denby.
Denby. Awesome. Because they're both part of... Well, you know, Cornelia's our guiding light at VARF. And I don't know about that. But we also have Courtney from the
Phoenix Event Alliance.
The Phoenix Event Alliance. So, and that's up and coming from the fair.
It's the fair is part of it. It was the impetus to create the alliance. As many people know, the Virginia Renaissance Fair has outgrown its site. We've leased a place for 15 years. But wow. We've frankly just plain run out of parking. And that's a good thing, but nobody wants to drive for 2 hours and get somewhere and then have to spend 40 minutes looking for a parking place.
No,
so
nobody does.
It's not quite that bad yet, but it will be if we don't plan ahead. So in the process of planning a new site for the fair, a new permanent site where we can build and do multiple events, it became pretty obvious that that was a lot of money to spend for a site that's actually going to be used 5 or 6 weekends a year, maybe another 3 or 4 scattered throughout. So with the help of Spotsylvania County's Economic Development Director, we started looking at what else can you do? What we could do is bring together disparate groups that had the same kind of philosophy that we at VARF have. I mean, the Renaissance Fair at Virginia has a very distinct philosophy on how to create an event, how to carry off an event. So what I did is I found like-minded people in the performing arts, professional theater, dance, in sports, in folk arts, in food service, in landscape, and then Courtney came on board to handle our film and video department, because with all these interesting areas of expertise, he came up with the idea we should be documenting this process because it is unique, and also with the amount of expertise that's going to be coming onto this site for all these different things, perhaps an education, distance learning, an educational channel with distance learning would give us even a greater reach.
That sounds like the most solid plan I've heard ever.
What was really interesting is when we came up with it, and it was a process of developing, I would take something to economic development and he would say, think bigger. And I'd come back and I'd come up with a few, take it back, no, think bigger. And then I came in one time and I said, okay, here it is. and he said, yeah, that'll do. but when he went out to investigate how other such parks were doing across the country, he found something really interesting. He found out there aren't any parks like what we're proposing anywhere in the country. Common Ground Event Park is really unique in that it takes multiple, not necessarily related disciplines, and finds ways that they can interrelate, interact, and create something greater than the sum of the parts.
Wow. I mean, this is turned from, you know, in a way, Phoenix resurrecting
the fair.
Into not only a mission, but a humanitarian project.
But wait, there's more. One of the things we've learned from the fair, and I know, Jim, you know that, and Courtney knows that because you've been at the fair for quite some time, we have a number of special needs young adults who have been a part of our organization for some time and who, quite frankly, have blossomed as part of this organization. I personally think that we have something going on that somebody ought to document and probably investigate, because we have taken young people with autism and Asperger's and mental illness and serious developmental issues and disabilities, and they have grown at a time when they're out of the public school system, when they're over 21, and they've been pretty much considered done and dusted. And yet they come to fair, they become a part of the fair, and partly because of the training we give, and also in great measure because the atmosphere of acceptance and the belief that everybody can be the best they can be, these young people have grown in ways that frankly have astounded both their families and professionals that they work with. With that in mind, the question was, how can we assist this population as part of the Phoenix Event Alliance? I know you probably are aware that the school systems in Virginia identify special needs children when they're about 3 years old. Mm-hmm. And they scoop them up in the preschool system and they carry them all the way through until they are 21 years of age. And these they grow up in the arms of the school system where they have teachers, they have friends looking forward to seeing them, they have a place to go every day.
It's a lot of support.
Right, a tremendous amount of support. And the day they turn 21, they're dropped like a hot potato and have a nice life. So suddenly, you have parents in their 50s and late 40s who have a confused and probably angry adult who's quite often bigger than they are, wondering how come nobody wants them around anymore. There is nothing local, and I mean by local, I mean within 100 miles.
Oof.
Yes. That can, there are programs, but they're 150 miles away, 120 miles away. And then, and I'm told this by parents of these young adults, for you drive 150 miles each way for 45 minutes of activity once a month. I'm sorry, that's not acceptable.
No, not for people being a part of our society. That's, I mean, it's, we need to come together and make that a solution.
It's not inclusive. It's not considerate.
No, it's that's everybody should get the same handhold. Now, if people don't interact well together, that's their thing, but everybody should make sure that they have the exact same step up, hand up, and, well, to borrow a phrase from another podcaster, you know, a high tide raises all boats.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, you know, it shouldn't just be a couple boats and a few sink or
actually,
some are left at
actually,
the dock.
That's very well stated.
It should all, everybody should come up together. I mean,
had somebody asked me about this, okay, 20 years ago, my answer would be, well, I don't know. I don't have a solution. What's your solution? Because I got nothing. But what's happened, I've learned. I've been taught by these families over the last 17 years, actually 18 years for me, creating the Virginia Renaissance Fair. I have learned what things, how we can put everybody into that family of workers and concerned people, and how together we can create a safe, nurturing environment for everybody.
Helping right. Everybody find their own place.
Find their own
speed.
Place, right. And there's places for our Harvard-educated lawyers. There's places for our young people that are barely verbal. There's a place for all of it. We were very, very lucky to have stumbled upon this through the Renaissance Fair. And then I've been blessed with creating the people I found to create the Phoenix Alliance. This group of people came together for the very first meeting, not knowing each other whatsoever. And when this, it was like, It was like a family reunion. It was the funniest thing. People who didn't know each other. And you know, you get together with people you don't know, you're a little hesitant. Oh, not these people. It was, oh, I've got this idea. Really? My group, oh, my people can help you with that idea. What can we do? And somebody else pipes up, oh, heck yeah, let's do it. We can, I can do this and you can do that. And we can all together make this really cool event that focuses on the thing you like to do. And then we can do something for what you like to do. And then we'll do what I like to do, where we can all do it together. When we brought up the special needs population, it was astounding to find that every person in that room had an experience with the same population and had the same, I really want to do something, but I honestly don't know quite what to do about it feeling. So when we got together, that greater than the sum of the parts thing happened. And for example, my landscaper said, well, you know, I can teach anybody to plant petunias 6 inches apart. I mean, what I can't do is supervise a bunch of everybody's planting petunias 6 inches apart. However, I've been working with wounded warriors, these service people who've given all and have come home without limbs. They feel like they've lost their purpose, that they have no reason to be anymore. And he said, what I found is I can team up someone who's got the intellectual wherewithal, but maybe not the limbs, with someone who is very willing to do whatever they can with those limbs as long as you give them guidance. And we said, cool, works for us. Let's team them up and see how far we can get. So everyone in the group, the equestrian group, the folk arts group, the farm-to-table food service, the landscape and conservation, everyone, the Courtney's group, and he'll probably talk about that in a bit, he does the film and video and the educational outreach. We're talking about doing some distance learning. The sports people, every single group has a place where we can combine everyone's needs and make this one.
Wow, this is a strong start to this podcast.
Okay, I'm done now.
No. I'm saying that this is one of those podcasts where we have not only a reenactor, we have a creator, a fair constructor from the ashes, and we also have someone who's not only taken this as a direction and a mission, but has started it moving in the natural, until it becomes a natural force where it's just moving forward. Yes. And, you know, hearing about this, I mean, we're going to talk about, you know, some of the dumb little questions that I throw together, because I really want these reenactors to have a face behind their character. Without them having to break it. Because I know there's so many people out there that, you know, get to fair and they're like, oh, you know, break your character. Do I know? I know you. Da, da, da. And we want to give them that voice. But this is also just as important, if more so, than bringing out that personal aspect. But giving all these people the chance to have that mask. To bring out from to bring themselves out from behind it. This is the root of why, you know, I kind of lean toward this, because I like interviewing people. I'm like getting to know why they do things, where they started, what was that little leaf that grew into a tree that became that, you know, character, that person, that that source. And this is one of those things where I'm excited to hear about it. I've heard little bits and pieces, and you want to make sure at the end of it, when we release this, I want to make sure that you have all the information put on the end of it. So if somebody hears this and goes, well, okay, this sounds like a really awesome purpose. How can I help? You know, here's the information, the Facebook, the, you know, whatever websites you want to put up. We'll spend 20 minutes on websites if it'll get people in contact. I have Friendster. No problem. Friendster. Wow. Friendster, it's like, oh, what was the, what, it just died. Not, it didn't just die.
MySpace?
MySpace.
Oh.
That was way back in the day. We're not going to be aging or dating ourselves at all at this point.
I apologize for that non sequitur. I just couldn't help myself.
No. That is the best part about this particular art form, is just picking, talking, joking around. This is, we're inviting people to come in and listen to our conversation and be yourselves.
Be human.
So, no, I the last podcast, Kristen, my co-host, who gets here later on, and Katie, who's going to be occasionally coming in, switch hitting. Say hello.
Katie? No, shake your head so we can hear something.
She's waving.
And she's shaking her head.
Kristen kind of grilled me on what my character was, because I wanted to introduce myself to the people who'd be listening. But in this case, you know, this is moving on to, not only are we reenactors, but look at the force we're gathering.
Yes.
Look at the force of purpose, or the purpose and force, the direction we're taking the force with purpose. So let's
talk fair.
Let's talk fair for a couple minutes, and then we're gonna go much more into the Common Ground Event Park and getting the support for it. So you have played at more than one festival.
I have. I've played. Well, there had been in 1996 the Virginia Renaissance Fair that was by Renaissance Entertainment Corp. Mm-hmm. out of, I believe, Colorado, built the first fair in Virginia, and I was part of the original cast. I was there for 3.5 years.
Hmm.
And then we had a parting. We had a difference in philosophy, and so we went our separate ways. But they invited me to come and perform at their big flagship show up in Kenosha, Wisconsin, the Bristol Renaissance Fair, which
wow.
is massive. And it's one of the grand old men of Renaissance fairs. Brilliant show, just lovely. So I was up there for a couple of years. I've performed at a former show in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
I performed sort of impromptu at Southern California Pleasure Fair, but that was just because I happened to be there and they said, oh, you're here, so do something. So Louisiana Fair, things like that. Pennsylvania, had a blast in Pennsylvania.
Oh, wow. So what are your characters? Do you have any particular characters you do?
Well, I started out at the old fair as Mistress Miller. She was something of a snarky middle-class woman. But then when I started performing at other fairs, I became Mildred Cecil. She was born Mildred Cook. She had a lot of sisters who married very well. One married Francis Bacon. We were all very, very well educated. My character, Mildred, was educated with Elizabeth Tudor when we were both girls by Robert Ashum. And so my character fits very well with this year's theme at the fair about educating women, since she became quite a writer. She translated a lot of ancient texts, mostly religious texts. She was a Puritan, but unable to publish under her own name, except in secret. When she became ill and was dying, her husband found out that she had been filling the local university libraries with her own works. He was not pleased. But I've been Mildred for a long time now, and I really like her. In fact, a few years ago, I packed up my kit and took it to England and took Lady Burleigh, Baroness Burleigh. I took Lady Burleigh home to her, to Burleigh House in England. And on their website, they posted a picture of me and garb on their grand staircase and said, after 450 years, Baroness Burleigh came home for a visit.
that's
priceless.
Wow. that is amazing. I should even think about the historical concept of playing that character and then showing up at that character's.
Oh, it took tremendous chutzpah. As one of the docents that was there, as she was looking down her nose at me and said, and you are supposed to be who again? And I said, your mistress, and trust me, she would ne'er have worn such a brilliant outfit around her home, but she has just come from court, where, as you know, our Lady Queen doth expect much more.
Wow. Wow. You have this character, you've done shows with it. What do you do at the fair right now with your character? I mean,
oh, with my character, I actually don't become her until about 3:30. Mm-hmm. Depends on when Katie gets there to help me get dressed. Dressing Lady Burleigh has been a triumph this year of Will. I do a bit with Katie together. Mm-hmm. We do a show called What Are You Wearing? And we talk about how the fashion for men and women and children of our time is more than just clothing. It is actually an expression of our culture, and there are reasons for every single thing on our body. So, and it's not all about modesty, it's more about protection, it's more about showing where we stand in the great chain of being, where our status is. And as Katie points out, as a member of the emerging middle class, as part of social upheaval, in that there is this middle class, and people like me don't know quite what to do with that. So it's a real conundrum.
Yeah, I mean, and it was not only form function, but it was like fashion was today. Not only did it have to fit form and function, but it had to look good doing it.
Right, and there was no common denominator of blue jeans that you could dress up or dress down. Every piece of your clothing had form and function, and since fabric itself was so incredibly expensive, it was a sign of wealth. It was a sign of your lineage. My house, Burleigh House, we have our own livery. Each of the big estates have livery. Livery being the clothing that you dress your servants, your household staff in, so that when they are about, they are under your personal protection. The livery of the house, the Lord Stafford, the livery of his house is blue. But everyone has their own livery color, and they are recognizable in and about as from the House of Burleigh, or the House of Stafford, or the House of Essex.
It was almost like an identification.
It was their uniform. It was their daily uniform. Wow. And there was a lot that had to do with clothing. Different occupations required, just as they do today, a certain, you said form and function, but you needed to be recognized from a distance. Because if you are a traveler coming new to a town and you don't know anyone, you want to be able to look around and say, that man is a blacksmith. I'll follow him so that I can get shoes for my horse. It was very important. So that's what we do every day. And some days we don't have an audience, so we visit with people passing by, and other days we have a fantastic audience. Often it's the ladies who sit down, but it's the men and their sons who stay, because this is something they've never thought about. They thought it was just going to be some fluff talk about, oh, this isn't this a pretty dress, and then they find out it's all about who's who and what's what, and they're all about it. They stay.
Status symbols and protection.
Status, protection, and then we throw in all kinds of factoids. We talk about the weather, we talk about chemistry, we talk, you name it, we've money, we've got it all covered.
Wow. And you mentioned previously that you started in 1996?
I started in 96, right.
Wow. And that was at the original Virginia Fair.
Right. My daughter was a working actress. She'd been working since she was 12 down in D.C., and she'd been in movies and things like that. Mm. And she was hired off of her headshot and resume. But when they hired her, she was 15, and I was driving her up and down and up and down, mm-hmm. taking her to rehearsals. And they called me up one day and said, you know, you're all pretty funny. How would you like to do a part of this? And I said, no. My background's in medicine, and no. And they said, oh, well, but you have to bring her anyway. So come anyway and bring that nice young man. Well, her boyfriend, Stephen Loy, used to bring her on the days that I could not. So the nice young man, Stephen Loy, has been for some time our director of fight, and is still with us. And then one day, because my daughter was in the television arts program at her high school, they came out to film some of it, which is how we dragged Courtney kicking and screaming out there. Get in the car, Courtney. Just get in the car.
Victim teared, voluntold.
Yes, literally. Oh, there's more.
This is going to be one of those episodes, and there's more.
But wait. So that's how it started. And then I became a little too vocal at that fair. I worked in the children's area. And as the fair went from season to season, they became quite commercialized, which is great. A lot of fairs, you know, it's a fair philosophy. It's a business philosophy. Jim, these are a business, folks. And if you don't think it's a business, you have been living in la-la land, because this is a business and we have to run it like a business. That being said, not every business has the same corporate philosophy. And as I said a couple of years ago to some people, you don't have to be just like everybody else, but you do have to have a conviction and the courage to stick to it. Our fair will never have the 300,000 that the Bristol Renaissance Fair has, or the Pennsylvania, or the Maryland Fair, or the Georgia Fair, or you pick your fair, or heaven knows, Texas. We'll never have that. But you know what? That's okay. Because the way we do things, we like interaction, we like education, and we like to have a more intimate one-on-one or group, small group on one interaction with our patron base. At 300,000, we can't hope to do that. We might be able to do it at 50, but I can't do it at 300. And so rather than do what it would take to get the 300,000 and abandon our fair philosophy, we have agreed as a company, and I think as our cast and crew and volunteer staff sign on to, we will do what we do. We will do it the very best we can, and we are happy with that.
It's not just happiness. This is a change in philosophy for business that I will, in my opinion, say needs to happen. Because you guys, like I said, it's very much like almost a force of nature. You guys may think that, you know, we wouldn't be able to do 300,000, but we don't know how far this will go. And once we get a solidified site, that's going to, you know, go in leaps and bounds, because every fair, once they got a solidified site, just one step after another ranking up the numbers.
It's going to require a great deal of thought, and I think much harder work than just going with it. And for example, the old fair got sponsors. They had wonderful sponsors who threw in a phenomenal amount of money. They had Play School. They had, I don't remember all of them. I remember Play School because they were sponsoring the children's area. And that's when I piped up and I said, do we really need a big plastic block at the Renaissance Fair? Because it doesn't really say Elizabethan England to me. And I was told, well, yes, at our fair, it's going to say Play School, and which is a great company, and I support them wholeheartedly. I buy lots of their stuff for my grandkids. My only comment was that it tended to take away from the 16th century ambiance, and maybe there was another way to do it.
Yeah, it could have been very easily. They could have just made some more of the stuff out of
Play
woods.
I think Play School would have cared.
As long as they were represented.
Exactly. But that wasn't my place to say it. And so my mouth got in the way, and I was asked that maybe I should perform somewhere else. So I did. It was okay. And then when that fair folded, it left a really big empty in a lot of us. They left, and for a year there, we had nothing. And
They literally stripped out the entire Virginia Ren Fair and like shipped their all the parts to other places.
They had five fairs.
Oof.
And they took all their things and all our things and they went to other fairs, which is their prerogative. But it left such a hole in your soul. And it wasn't that you got to get hot and sweaty or freezing frickin' cold in the rain all day. It was that once you felt that thing about making people smile and giving that peace and making their day special, it's like this drug. It's my drug of choice now.
Yeah.
And so I thought about it, and I had one of those milestone birthdays coming up, like really big milestone birthdays. And so for my 50th birthday, I cashed out my retirement, and I said to a group of people, I think I can do this. Who's with me? And enough people said, we're with you. We started out with 18 cast members, 9 vendors, and a horse.
and the horse is the important part, the horse.
It was, because the guy on it had armor and it was good enough for most people. But we toured Virginia, Maryland, even in Pennsylvania for the first 2 years. Man, that's hard. Holy cow. You know, you do a show all day. You drive out Friday, take a half day off work, you drive to wherever you're going to be, you unload the truck. You put up the fair site. You do a fair all day Saturday, all day Sunday. You get your costume off Sunday. You take everything down. You pack up the truck. You drive the truck home. You unload the truck at 1 o'clock in the morning and show up at work at 7. And I'm too damn old for that.
So, I've had to do that a couple times.
Yeah. So that's when we said we got to settle down. And we found the Lake Anna Winery, who, God love them, had absolutely no idea what they were getting into. Yeah, we showed up and said, how would you like to have a Renaissance fair? And they went, yeah, well, sure, why not? What the heck? We have been there 15 years, and they've been wonderful hosts. But
wow.
We have outgrown their lovely site, and it's time to go.
No, that sounds completely fair. Fair.
Fair.
So did you do any acting before this? Or?
Oh, no. Oh, you know, high school junk. I had dance lessons from the time I was 3 until I was 18. 16. 7, yeah, 18. And, you know, I did high school stuff. Not really. I was a stage mom for my daughter. I mean, that was, you know, when you've got a kid who's working professionally at 12, you learn a lot about how to play that game. And there's some real unsavory parts of that game. So, was part of what part of our fair philosophy was, we will always take the high road.
Mm-hmm.
We will do what is right, even if sometimes it's the hardest thing to do, because at the end of the day, it will serve us well in the long haul. In 17 years, that philosophy has proven true over and over.
I mean, with the fair growing the way it is, it's a good philosophy. It's working well, and
people
it's a good way
know.
To do it.
The people who know these things came to me when I started the fair and said, you know, that's pretty Pollyanna.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, my counter to that, especially what we've seen over the last 17 years, is those people that know, yeah, their entire concern was money. And what I have observed with the blossoming of the Virginia Renaissance Fair is that the nurturement of a community, that's literally what I've seen with VARF.
I think that's true. I mean, yes, they're interested in money, but they're running it as a business. And I applaud that. You know, it is a business, and they make a ton of bucks at these big shows. And they're run like a business, and I understand that. For me, and I think my initial motivation was, I had a full-time job. I worked it until I was 62, and then I retired. And man, that was hard during fair season, as you know. But
oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. But I think my motivation initially was so different. I would like to have a place. Ultimately, when we have a permanent site and we can operate on doing multiple kinds of things year round, all different kinds of things. I want to create jobs. I want to be able to pay people. For a lot of people don't realize, our show is all volunteer from me on down. Everybody.
Something we've pointed out several times on the podcast so far, even in the three or four that we've done, it's all been about, and everyone's volunteer.
Everyone's volunteer. And as you well know, I never ask anybody to do anything I wouldn't do myself, which is why if you see me walking across site with rubber gloves, bleach, and a set of rubber, you know, and paper towels, I'm cleaning a porta-john. So, you know, the one thing I don't do that I do ask other people to do is deal with snakes, because Corny don't do snakes. Locomoting without legs ain't natural. It just is not going to be part of my skill set ever, and God forgives me for that.
I can understand. And you've been a complete plethora of good stories, and let's... This is just your part for it for a while, and then we talk to Courtney directly for a couple minutes before he runs, and then we do like a free-for-all kind of talk and conversation after we do some interviews, and we can definitely fit the common ground into the free-for-all. what other hobbies do you have besides, I mean, this isn't a hobby, this is a business.
Started out as a hobby,
but
it didn't last as a hobby very long.
So, what kind of fun things do you do that may be related, may not be related?
Absolutely love to travel. My husband's mother's family is British, mm-hmm. was Welsh actually, and he has a cousin who lives in one of these beautiful British Downton Abbey, not that big, but British estate homes that has. Of the servants' bells in the kitchen and the back stairs for the servants' quarters and everything. It's just fun. It's just so fun to be able to go over there and play. But we travel. I do a lot of sewing. I belong to the American Sewing Guild and go to the annual conventions whenever possible.
Wow.
Draft my own patterns and do a lot of that. My grandmother had her own business as a garment business, and so it sort of comes to me honestly. But so I sew, and I do, you know, not as much handwork as I used to because I'm a woman of an age and the arthritis in my hands is starting to be a bit of a thing. But just that, and I love people. I really love people. My children used to be mortified because I'll talk to anybody. And you can usually find a common denominator. You just never know. And I'm an absolutely rabid Ohio State alumna.
Well,
go Bucks.
I am a people as a hobby is pretty much what I'm doing right here.
Indeed.
and we can talk about like really good stories later on, some more, but and I'll think about a best experience, just think about it for a little bit. But what is we asked this everybody, what is your favorite show at the fair? And you can say yours, that's fine.
Good heavens.
What's that show you gotta watch at least once a season?
Okay, and My motivation is going to be odd here. My favorite show for the last few years has been The Rogues, and you're going to think, well, they're one of our paid stage acts. Yes, they are. In case you haven't heard them, they're a Celtic band. They've got pipe and drums and mm-hmm. just drive America's Celtic band. They're just driving music and everything. Well, I spend a lot of my day walking around that site, and if you haven't been to the site, there's a hill. It's not a big hill. It's a slow, gradual incline. But as the day goes on, I swear to God, that incline gets bigger and bigger. And toward the end of the day, it's about 60 degrees, and you need a rope to climb up. But when I hear The Rogues, and they give me a good, and they told me they see me do this, I get a drum cadence and a good beat. I'll skip until I've got my left foot coming down on first beat, and I can go anywhere on that site. I can walk, if I have a drum cadence, man, it's the marching band in me. I can go forever on that site. And it just, it makes my day go faster.
I can't disagree.
Love it. I just love it. But you know, there's little things. There's the little things. Like, I love Sue Tillman's Mistress Hilly's lecture about food. I love to pick that up. It's kind of low key. It's not one of the big showy things that we do. We have a lot of comedy. We have a lot of showy things. But she packs so much information into her quiet, and she works while she's talking, and her hands are always busy, and she has her staff. It's fluid. It's graceful. It's filled with interesting factoids. And she wrote a little cookbook that we sell in the gift shop that she didn't have to do. She just called me one day and she said, I was thinking of writing a cookbook. If I do it, would you put it in the gift shop? She doesn't get anything out of it. But I said, well, sure. And it's that little thing. I love to see children trying on armor in the militia. I love watching the children's butterfly dance at the end of the day out of Poppets when they have their little butterfly scarves. There's so many little pieces that happen. When I look up and it's raining and Bobby Herbst, the Riddler, Master Quill, is dancing across the site in the rain to whatever music is playing, those are the things that are my favorites. Those
That's
little
Bobby.
Those little moments are just so special.
So your favorite show happens to be The Varf Show.
Yes, it is. We create something when we teach people to create a character. And that's actually that creating a character is the thing that seems to reach our special needs young people. They may not be able, for example, they may not be able to pick up on social cues during the day as a matter of course. And we all know people like that who just don't get it. And we're always kind of awkward around them in conversation stuff because they don't get us and we don't get them. But when we teach people to create a fair character, and we start with what's your name and who's your parents and who are your siblings and what's your occupation and do you know how to read and things like that, and they create this character, what happens is they're able to incorporate the things they learned about creating the character, which includes who do I bow to? Oh, that person is sparkly and gold. I bow to them. Oh, that person isn't, so maybe I don't have to bow to them. They start to incorporate that into their normal day-to-day interactions with people, and suddenly they've grown as an individual. Again, someone needs to study that. It's not going to be me. But I think it's a valid observation. The scientist in me likes that. That is, it's a valid observation, and we've observed it with a number of people over time and watched them grow year after year after year. Mm. So I think the Varf Show, the fact that we've created all these interactive characters and empowered them, they don't have, in some cases they have a small script, but most of the time we have empowered these people to go out and engage the public and be entertaining, whatever an entertaining is to you. For Master Quill, he does riddles. For Spoonie, she's got her big spoon, and she does stuff with spoons. And for the militia, they do stuff with whatever your character is. My character is I just talk to people and ask them about their attire. But everyone, we have empowered people to take whatever inspires them, what comes from inside them, and develop it and throw it out there. And also, we've empowered them to be allowed to fail, to throw it out there, and if everybody looks at them like they just grew a third head, okay, that didn't work. What's the worst that could happen?
That's awesome.
You take it out. Well, that's what my father said. My parents let me, encourage me. I'm a spoiled only child. Okay. And they encouraged me to try. Just do it, because what's the worst that can happen? You fail. They would pick me up. They'd dust me off. If I had gone forward against their advice, they reserved the ability to say, I told you so, while they were dusting me off. And then they said, okay, go try it again. Maybe it'll work a different way.
Oh, God.
We don't have enough of that today. Everyone, especially with our SOLs in school, we've got these kids so afraid that they're going to give the wrong answer, so afraid that they won't do it right. Stop being afraid that you're not going to do it right. Go with your gut. You know what's right. Maybe you won't get it perfect the first 2, 3, 4 times, Just keep trying. What's the worst that could happen?
I mean, if nothing else, the experience of not getting it right is how we learn. And I think, and that's one of the things that really baffles me. It's like we're taught, oh, you can't, you have to be right all the time. That it's somehow a sin to be wrong, but that's how you learn. It's almost a trap.
Exactly.
And it's definitely a trap we're trying to avoid, but you know, socially it gets stuck and we're like,
exactly. It's socially conditioned that you can't be wrong, and that, you know, But that is how you become more, by trying and failing. But if you're not allowed to, or you're taught that you're not allowed to, what does that do to you?
Okay. And there's different versions of right. Jim, when you perform, your characters are so great. There's no way in the world I can be anywhere like your characters. And the same with Katie. Although in a lot of ways we're very similar, and yet she has a completely different... We do the same subject together. We tag team it. The very first time we did it, you would have thought we'd been doing this for 6 years. Mm-hmm. It was amazing because we had the same love, we had the same goal, but we just came at it from different directions. No one's going to be all things to all people. Nobody. My fair is not for everybody. Our fair. All four of us. It's our fair. But you know, we're not all things to all people. That's okay.
Oh,
I don't want to be all things. And I see the Groupon. We do a Groupon in the spring for a couple of weekends, and I get a lot of reviews. And 98 of the reviews were, wow, I'd never been, and I had a great time. And 2 of the reviews are, oh, well, that sucked. I'm not going back there. What a waste of my money. And I write to every one of them, and I say, thank you for coming. Sometimes we're just not everybody's cup of tea, but don't give up on Renaissance fairs. There's a lot of different ones out there.
Yeah.
Go to one of the others that are local. Maybe that's more your thing.
Oh, that's completely fair. I keep saying that. It's completely fair. Fair.
Yeah.
Fair. Let the puns begin. But we are going to give you a minute, and we're going to think about best experiences. I'm going to hold best experiences to the end. I think that's going to be, that's one of those things where you have to think about it, and because you'll sit there and go, I had this really, wait, no, there, this one was, wait, no, this one was better.
I mean, right off the bat, the first time, the resurrection of the Phoenix, Williamsburg, the Mud Show. Oh, my goodness.
I've heard of this. I have not.
Oh, epic, isn't it?
I've heard of it. I haven't gotten the whole story. But
and even more so, what was it? Central Park.
Central Park was the miracle in the mud.
Yes. there was the first ever show in Williamsburg, and then there was the miracle in the mud in Central Park. Those two.
Wow. Yes. Well, so Courtney, we've got some questions to ask you, because you've been dipping in every once in a while and conversing. We're not going to try to put you too much on the spot.
No, you know, that's almost, I mean, in relation to the Virginia Renaissance Fair, that's almost been the story of my life in relation to VARF. I've been, you know, in at the beginning and then kind of, you know, just kind of, you know, in and out and in and out and in and out.
A boomerang just keeps going back. Just the guy keeps dodging. It just keeps coming back. Get in the car, Courtney. So, so who did you play at VARF, or did you have multiples?
Well, pretty much what happened was that I initially, when VARF was resurrected, I like to call it the Great Phoenix. When that happened, I was more or less kind of support. I helped with logistics. I, you know, would, you know, do fence stakes and things of that nature. Just help with whatever needed to be done back in those earlier days. And sometime in being away and coming back, I somehow got drafted into being cast.
Well, you started out as sort of a security guy and then White Knights.
Yes.
Right. Oh. And then he became a character.
When we release, you have to listen to Spear and Spoon, which is episode 2.
Yes.
Which is Zell and Spoonie and, well, Natalie. Zell, very similar. But you'll listen to it and hear it out. But I'll tell you after we close out. So who? Go ahead. Okay, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
So pretty much my, I can't remember. It's been years since I've actually been directly engaged. Ever since the PEA became, you know, started picking up more steam, I kind of been pulled away from being in character. But I was originally, over the last couple years prior, I was involved with the Merchant Adventurers. I had a character whose father was you know, a master of a ship. His mother was a Moor, and keep in mind his father was also Portuguese, and so you can imagine no love lost in relation to Espana. Yeah. and so I pretty much when I was cast for that period of time as that character, I was with Master Jim, and he and I had a routine, and commonly he would call my character the Portuguese.
The Portuguese.
Espada!
I can remember. I can remember Jim saying,
yes.
I can imagine Jim saying something like that. And have you worked at any other fair or just this
one? No, Varf.
Just Varf. Which, that's going to be an upcoming theme for a lot of our interviewees. And besides the Merchant Adventurers, what were you specific? Were you his, like, bosun, his second in command?
Mainly I was his bosun. Pretty much one of the common things that we often did was we would do demonstrations of cannon drill. We split up the various facets of life on a ship, and that was one of the things where we often came together, where we would both, you know, technically cannon drill would be a four-person operation, but he and I would, like, somehow manage to do it just with two.
Wow. Well, I mean, I'm guessing you could fire a two if you lost enough people on the ship.
If you were that desperate, I mean, if you were absolutely desperate, yeah, it would be tough, but it could be done, but...
No, I get that one. So cannon drill with Jim, you had your character. What was your character's name?
Gosh, it's been so long.
If you can't remember, that's fine. I just sometimes, you know, well, I have people like ask questions of like, if I could just remember that name, I could remember so much.
I very much tended to be, aside from doing cannon draw, I tended to be in the background.
Wow.
It's been so long since I played that character, I can't even remember his name.
I would ask you how you got into working a Ren Fair, but Courtney, get in the car.
There's a little bit more, but I mean, I'm not sure. Are we allowed to talk about Fear Fest 2008?
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
That's a convention, I'm guessing.
No. What Fear Fest was, 2008 was something that the REC Corporation
It wasn't 2008.
Oh, no,
that
no,
was
no.
98.
Oh, you're correct, 98.
Yes,
yeah,
years ago.
I'm dating myself.
A little gray in that beard, Courtney.
we don't date. Well, on Renaissance Recall, we carbon date.
No, Cornelio is correct. It was 1998, and that was just before, that was the preseason just before REC closed down. Mm-hmm. But they had this experiment that they were doing with what they called Fear Fest. And so it was kind of like a haunted trail. They turned a section of the fair site, you know, converted into a haunted trail, and you know, they had these little vignettes along the way, and what would happen is they'd have one cast member at the front of this rope, mm-hmm. another cast member at the end of the rope, and then all the patrons would be shoehorned in the middle between the two, and they'd be told to go ahead and hold on to the rope. And of course, there's a ringer in the middle of the rope somewhere, and going through the vignettes, like maybe the third vignette, the ringer gets snatched away. Hold on to the rope. Here's your warning.
That should have happened in like the first vignette. I'm telling
okay,
you.
Okay, so I mean, and it's even more interesting that because I remember the first night in October, Cornelia dragged me there. I remember correctly, I was.
You were in the middle of some existential angst.
Yeah,
and showed up at the house.
and she was like, "Courtney,
we've all been there.
Get your ass in the car."
I don't have time for this. Get in the car.
Oh my god!
And so we're out in like somewhere out in the fields of King George, was it King George?
Yeah, right on the Stafford King George line.
Yeah, exactly. Somewhere in the Netherlands. And and so I'm around everybody else in this one large building. Everybody's dropping trow, you know, changing in the costume, and I'm kind of, you know, being introverted. It's like, so
we all start there, and we all end up with the we don't.
You haven't seen me in my underwear at this point. You haven't been looking.
Exactly. So. I mean, so I'll try to keep this short, but it was kind of.
Don't worry about it. We've got this isn't a radio spot. This is a open up, tell it how you feel, and go from there.
So they're trying to find something for me to do. I'm not quite cast material. I'm, you know, introverted and shy. So they drag me up a tree, literally, like, you know, this rope ladder rig into the rafters where they have all this rigging for, you know, for segments along the vignettes, and I'm like. Heights. That's a negatory Ghost Rider.
We're gonna put him in a tree. Heights, me, we don't get along. We don't get along at all.
So I climb my butt down from the tree, and they're like, "Well, what do we do?" So they decide to go ahead and put me at the very end of the entire haunted trail experience, and they, you know, introduced me to a couple guys. They gave me a pair of coveralls, like a flight suit, a tank of gasoline, and a
white hockey mask.
Oh yeah, the hockey mask and a chainsaw with no chain on it.
And Courtney found his calling.
Oh my god! So, I mean, okay, so this was the setup. They would go ahead and they'd get to the end of the trail, and keep in mind they have like a couple, like maybe two or three trains that they'd run simultaneously. Mm-hmm. You know, they had them just perfectly timed, but they want to get everybody cleared from that first train, you know, before the next train comes in. So, you know, the cast members go ahead and take up the rope. You know, it's like, all right, get on your way. And they would straggle. And then, you know, one of us guy on cleanup crew would come from underneath behind the tarp, you know. And some of the guys would just kind of just like, and I don't know, but I was wrong, because instead of just, you know, just ripping it from behind the tarp, I was evil and creepy, stalkerish. I would like, you know, just quietly slip from behind the tarp. Everybody has their back behind me, and I would just go ahead and try to get as close to the last person in line. And then, you know, about two steps away.
So great. Time I was playing Latvinia Holt Whistle, the fashion witch. Oh, you wore that? All right. You're not married, obviously.
Oh, wow.
But anyway, we would see the people, and I did line duty for weekend after weekend because it was so crazy. And these, one time we had a girls' soccer club come with the parents, and the girls were all in line, and we said, parents need to go first. So we sent the parents through first, and then when they came out the other side, there was a bridge that the when you exited the trail, they would go over the bridge, and that's when he would come out when they were on the bridge, and he'd sneak up behind them. So we got all the parents to come and stand at the other side of the bridge, and we said, wait for it. And it was great, because those little girls, you know, you heard the scream like a girl.
Oh!
It was wonderful.
Oh, my gosh.
It was great fun.
Courtney, did you have any acting before this or
none? I had 2 years prior experience in vocational study for media production, television broadcasting. I was the guy that didn't even want to sit learning how to be a director. I was in the engineering closet with the production engineer. I was learning about like diagnosing cables and white balancing cameras and things of that nature. I had no prior experience with acting prior to my time with Varf.
Wow.
Emily worked with him. She came home after the first few weeks of this class. Courtney was a year ahead of her in school. And she said, I really love this video, TV and video production thing, because she was used to being in front of the camera. Mm-hmm. And that's what she was doing. And she said, but there's this really intense guy in this class, and he's so good, Mom. And that was Courtney. And so the two of them make a really nice pairing, and here we are 20-some years later and...
trying to find ways how to co-conspire.
Hi, still at it.
Co-conspiring is always a good thing. So, let's see. I mean, I'm guessing a lot of your hobbies are media related.
actually, no. Prior to my involvement with the PEA, I had not touched anything with media production for quite some time. I had a one-off project with one of my close friends who wrote a screenplay. Mm-hmm. Quick story. He saw a movie, or he saw the box of a DVD. He read the back of it, and he thought he was going to see this particular viewing experience. He plays the DVD, and it was nothing like what they described on the back. And he was so disappointed because he was really looking forward to what he thought he was going to see. So that inspired him to write a screenplay of something similar to what he thought he was going to see. And so he's like, well, I have this screenplay now. What do I do with it? I can go ahead and sell it, or I can try to, you know, produce it. So he eventually decided he wanted to make sure the story was told, you know, to truth. So he went ahead and, you know, produced it himself. He went ahead and got a student director, cinematographer. He had pulled me in because he knew I had prior experience with AV and media production. So I worked as a production engineer. Technically, there were like years between my time in the vocational study, like decade and a half between that and this TV project, this movie project. And then what? We're now talking about another 10 years since that movie project and the PEA. So I really haven't had much to do with media production, you know, in between.
Okay, so what are your... I tapped my microphone.
Oh.
I did a faux pas. So what are your hobbies?
Okay, so pretty much aside from teaching myself, trying to teach myself how to play guitar, I wouldn't call it music. It's more or less like experimentations and noise.
You see that guitar right there? That was lovingly purchased for me, and I have yet to play a single song on it.
Yeah, I'm pretty much...
I'm going to get yelled at for right after this.
Yeah, my inspiration is mainly bass guitar. I'm kind of a closet knuckle dragger. I kind of like, you know, like heavier forms of music, and I would just love to kind of, you know, play bassist on some tracks like that. I also have this other closet interest. I've always been intrigued with Unix environments, if anybody knows what that is. So, something of a closet nerd.
Aren't we all? Climbed a mountain.
Oh gosh, what, Mount Washing Machine? That was what, 2001?
Mount Washing Machine?
Mount Washington, New Hampshire.
New Hampshire. Okay.
6,288 feet.
Mount Washing Machine.
That's awesome. That was quite an experience.
We almost had freeze-dried Courtney after that.
Yes, literally. Actually, that was the same person who wrote that screenplay that I was talking about. He was a very close friend and a mentor, but he and I, we worked together in a government facility, and we're both getting out of work early, and he said, "Hey, you know, I'm a mountaineer and such, and I'm going to be doing this climb, and it's a relatively easy one. If you're interested, here, it's going to be in April." I'm like, okay, cold weather, heights, not fond of that. That's a negatory ghostwriter. And so, I mean, my initial instincts was like, I don't like cold, I don't like heights, I'm out. But I had this nagging feeling. It's like I thought about it like maybe about 2 days, 5 days later, and it just came back up for consideration. And I just had this hunch. It's like, damn it, it's not one of those experiences where I don't want to go, but something says I need to go.
I get you.
Yeah, in other words, it's not so much a matter of if I'm going to be happy, but I don't know what I was going to get from it, but I knew that there was some learning experience that was on the other side of that. And regardless of my personal insecurities and doubts and discomforts, I had to go through that regardless.
Wow.
How long
yeah. did it take? Oh, gosh. The funny thing is that I don't know where to start with this, because we drove up to New Hampshire, Thursday the entire day. And our plan was we were going to go ahead and get up to high camp Friday morning, and we were going to go ahead and, you know, just kind of knock around and exercise, since this was my first time on a freaking snow-capped mm-hmm. mountain. And we were going to go ahead and try to do an actual summit attempt that Saturday and then drive home Sunday. Well, we got there Thursday night, had dinner, was keeping track of the weather, and they were expecting a heavy weather front to come in Saturday. So we got him to get a, you know, slightly late start from Hermit Lake. No, pardon me. Pinkham Notch. We make our way up to Hermit Lake, so we leave like about 9 in the morning, which is kind of late. Get up there about 12:30, set up camp at Hermit Lake. And it's about 1 o'clock, 1:30, and it was myself, my friend Eric, you know, the veteran mountain climber / adventurer, Chad, the professional adventure racer, and then Uncle Dave, one of Eric's mentors, who also had experience in mountaineering. And he was like in his 50s at the time. And so Uncle Dave was having to, you know, sit back. He had eye surgery. But Chad was like, here, let's go ahead and do a summit attempt right now. It's like, it's 1:30. It's kind of late. And it's like, I'm the freaking new guy here. You and Eric, you know, I trust Eric with my life. You know, we've been through some stuff, you know. And they're like, yeah, we can do this safely. So here we go, getting a late start. And so we eventually get up to the top of the head wall. And it's about maybe 5 o'clock. We have lunch. Actually, it's about 4:30. We have lunch. And there's our people coming down from the summit cone about the time that we're having lunch. And we have lunch. We got in. We're, you know, seeing the clouds coming in. It's like, okay, cool. And snow had already started a little bit while we were actually on the head wall. So the first group of people come down as we're coming up, and we're like, hey, how long to the summit, to the top of the summit? And like, oh, 15 minutes. So we're trekking up 15 minutes, and the winds have already started to pick up a bit. And, you know, we come across another group, and hey, how long to the summit? 15 minutes. And the group 15 minutes prior told us that already. So
danger
so,
will
wait, 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 what?
So, and 15 minutes later, once again, now, maybe about 10 minutes after that third group that told us 15 minutes, we eventually get up to the, you know, the main road, because I'm not sure if you're familiar, there's actually a weather observatory at the top of Mount Washington. Mount Washington has the world record recorded land wind speed, what, 1931 of 213 miles an hour. and so we you know, the winds weren't too terribly bad, but we're finally like up, you know, like on the on the top of the summit cone on freaking pavement and crampons and walking poles, literally leaning into the wind, hustling to get behind some weather observatory building, and they're like, cool, we're here, we're done. You know, my friend Eric actually had this commemorative flag that he had made for Uncle Dave. And but Uncle Dave was, you know, hanging out with the ladies back at high camp. So it's myself, Eric, and Chad. And so, you know, Eric hands me the one end of this flag, and, you know, we're holding it, and Chad's taking video of this experience while we're hunkered behind the weather of the
snow is
building.
This way,
you know, so we're having our moment, and then Eric takes complete control of the flag. And he's like, you know, holding it up, and the wind is just blowing this thing to the left and upwards and to the right, and this thing's just going all over the place. So we eventually, you know, in the dark, 6 p.m., we make our way down, you know, down the summit cone, down the head wall, And, you know, we, you know, camp out for the night, and Saturday morning we, you know, decide, okay, I think we're good. We'll go ahead and head back down to to Pinkham Notch. We eventually get home Sunday, and Eric looks up the stats for the time that we were actually on the summit, and it was like 190 miles, gusting winds. That's not correct. It was about 90 miles sustained with gust up to 110, 112.
Wow.
And cold.
Let's not forget the cold.
I threw an extra one in there. It was actually about 90 to 95 sustained, about 110 to 112 gusting.
it still sounds bad.
Yes, that was my experience with Mount Washing Machine.
Mount Washing Machine. Okay, so we're gonna take a quick break.
Cool.
And I'll normally I throw something in between here, and then we go from there. So this is Jim Miller with Renaissance Recall, and we will have a lot more people on when we come back. But we're gonna take a little break, and we'll come right back after this. Thank you. Well, we ran over again. Thank you for tuning into Renaissance Recall. We're going to turn this into a part A, part B. So come join us again for our next episode of our next part of episode 4. Thank you, and come spend time with us at Renaissance Recall again.
Ha! Jamboree! Ho! Jamboree! Ho, you ringtail sailors coming up behind. Ho! Jamboree! Ho! Jamboree! Jenny, keep your tailpiece warm. Now, me lads, be of good cheer, for Lundy's Isle, it pulls quite near, so it's way down below, and stow your gear. Jenny, keep your tailpiece warm. Ha! Jamboree, ho! Jamboree, ho! Your ringtail sailors coming up behind. Ha! Jamboree, ho! Jamboree, Jenny, keep your tailpiece warm. Heartland Point's coming up in sight, on the port bow, sitting Lundy's Light, we'll be stoking up some fires tonight. Jenny, keep your tailpiece warm. Ha! Jamboree, ho! Jamboree, ho! Your ringtail sailors coming up behind. Ho! Jamboree, ho! Jamboree, Jenny, keep your tailpiece warm. Pilot cutters coming up ahead, there'll be no more horse meat or hardtack bread. Tonight we'll sleep in your feather bed. Jenny, keep your tailpiece warm. Ha! Jamboree, ho! Jamboree, ho! Your ringtail sailors coming up behind. Ho! Jamboree, ho! Jamboree, Jenny, keep your tailpiece warm. We'll make port by the end of day. We can see the girls standing on the quay, and as we leave, we'll be getting our pay. So, Jenny, keep your tailpiece warm. Ho! Jamboree! Ho! Jamboree! Ho! Your ringtail sailors coming up behind. Ho! Jamboree! Ho! Jamboree! Jenny, keep your tailpiece warm. Several weeks on shore, but a sailor lad, he must roam forevermore. So it's fare thee well to me, Liverpool whore. Jenny, keep your tailpiece warm.
Come on!
Ho! Jamboree, ho! Jamboree, ho! Your ringtail sailors coming up behind. Ho! Jamboree, ho! Jamboree, Jenny, keep your tailpiece warm.
Look at me now!
Jamboree, ho! Jamboree, ho! Your ringtail sailors coming up behind. Ho! Jamboree, ho! Jamboree, Jenny, keep your tailpiece warm.
One, two, three, four!
Jamboree.